Hello and a very warm welcome to Central Stage. Good to have you with us. Now, the new wave of Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip in November, Egypt's assuming a high profile on an international level of analysis, changing geopolitics in the Middle East, Palestine's status upgrade at the UN, Malala Yousafzai's being turned into the global symbol of girls' right to education, and of course, what's failure in 2012 to stop Syria's bloodshed. These are some important and thought-provoking developments that took central stage in 2012. Welcome back. Now, to further discuss the most thought-provoking developments of the past year, two top guests join us today. Now, in our Tehran studio, I'm delighted to be joined by an eminent political scientist. Dr. Mohammad Hassan Khani, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Central Stage.
My pleasure to be with you.
Now, Dr. Mohammad Hassan Khani is an academic staff member of the Faculty of Politics and Islamic Studies at Imam Sadegh University and fellow researcher at the Institute for Political and International Studies. Now, over the phone from Toronto, Canada, we're delighted to be joined by an established educator and scholar, Dr. Ahmed Al-Hashimi. Welcome to Central Stage.
Mr. Bijani, thank you very much for the warm invitation. I reciprocate the same feeling from a sunny day afternoon we have here.
Great. I'm very happy that you're enjoying the lovely weather in Toronto. Now, Dr. Ahmed Al-Hashimi is the founding director of Ihsan Muslim Heritage Society in Toronto. He's, among other things, presented several impressive articles on Mahdism doctrine in Tehran on several occasions. Time for a short break, but after the break, we'll be discussing the second half of the most important developments in 2012.
Last week, we studied the first in a two-part series of programs on the most significant and at the same time thought-provoking global developments affecting the world in general and the world of Islam in particular in the year 2012. Today, in this second and final part of the series, we will be looking at a number of other important developments of the past year. We'll put more emphasis on two very important developments in November. In the month of November, the new wave of Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip started and unfortunately, once again, claimed many innocent lives and left many more injured. As in earlier instances, the Israeli military claimed its actions were being conducted only for defensive purposes. However, what the world actually witnessed was highly disproportionate force being used against defenseless Gazans. That was probably not unexpected. But what some analysts and writers like Haroun Seddouri said most certainly was. They said, quote, Hamas emerges stronger from Gaza war. Later in that same month, in a historic move, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to upgrade Palestine's status at the UN from observer entity to observer non-member state, and that despite strong opposition and numerous threats by Israel and the United States. Although this was a less ambitious promotion than a full membership, which was vetoed by Washington a couple of years ago, it was still considered by analysts to be of paramount importance to the Palestinians and those supporting them in the world of Islam and elsewhere. Judging by the amount as well as the intensity of reaction and criticism coming from the United States and Israel, they too must have found this upgrade particularly important.
Welcome back. Great to have you with us. Now, we're talking about the most important developments of the past year. And in November, the new wave of Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip started and claimed many innocent lives and left many more injured. Now, the Israeli military claimed its actions were being conducted for defensive purposes. However, we know that disproportionate force was always used. But That was not unexpected, but what some analysts like Harun Sidiri said most certainly was. Dr. Hani, they actually said that Hamas, in fact, emerged stronger from Gaza war.
Yes, that was the case. I mean, not as an Iranian observer or as a Muslim observer who have maybe tendencies towards, I mean, the Muslims or Palestinians who have been the victims of this Israeli aggression for years. But if you look at the papers throughout the world, I mean, the day after the ceasefire, there were many comments on even Israeli papers. Haaretz wrote excellent article on the other American newspapers, and they shared this view that Hamas emerged more powerful. As you were mentioning and counting the most important events of the year, I noticed that it has not been the case for 2012 that the Middle East and our region has been hotspot.
Right.
And I mean, the place in which those most important events took place. For the past several years, even without any exaggeration, for the past few decades, things that has happened in this region has been among maybe the top five, top right. 10 events and most important thing. And most of them related to either Palestinian and Israeli issues, or for a number of years, Iraq, for example, right. was the case, Afghanistan was the case. So it's not new that something
happening in the Middle East.
In the Middle East has been the most important or among the most important things. But this specific case that you mentioned, I mean, the Israeli aggression and then the result was somehow overwhelmingly different.
Right.
And I would like to say why in a very short comment. You know, it was the first time that Israeli government actually accepted that they couldn't do anything more. I mean, they started this new aggression hoping that they can make up for the last Gaza war. So they had in mind that, okay, maybe by using this force and, I mean, this new wave of aggression, maybe they could somehow rebuild the image of Israel, which was destroyed because of the war with Hezbollah and the previous war with Gaza. But
right.
that was not the result that they expected. So in a way, Hamas emerged more powerful, and a recognition, not only from the Arab states or the Muslim states, but now Hamas is now a very strong political factor in the Middle East.
So you're saying that because of the change geopolitics?
Exactly. I mean, the result of this last Gaza war somehow changed the balance of power. I mean,
right.
now even those who are talking about the maybe reviving the new peace process or talking, I mean, bringing the different parties to the negotiation table, they know that Hamas is now there. I mean, they should, in one way or another, accepted the fact that unless they accept the views of Hamas and, I mean, accept the participation of Hamas in any process, any right. Peace process is doomed to failure. So in that sense, I mean, the last aggression of Israeli in Gaza was maybe, again, we are not exaggerating if we say that it was a total victory for Hamas politically. Also in terms of military capability that Hamas showed. And I want to remind you that it was the first time that the Hamas rockets actually, I mean, reached the streets of Tel Aviv.
But Iron Dome was,
yes,
was used. And
exactly.
They managed to, you know, block some
yeah.
of those rockets.
Yeah. So,
but you're saying a number of them managed to get through.
Yes, sure. I mean, the technology is there, but they couldn't prevent Hamas from hitting Israeli cities. And Hamas also, and something else which was very important, it was for the first time that Iran and Hamas both acknowledged that this military capability is due to the Iranian support and Iranian logistical support for Hamas. Again, this was something very new. Right. So in that sense, there are so many reasons that we can see that this was one of the most important events in 2012.
Thank you very much indeed for that. Now let's go to Toronto, where we're joined by Dr. Ahmad Al-Hashimi. Now we're talking, Dr. Al-Hashimi, about the Gaza war, and I'd like to also mention Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi's role. We know that he held actually talks with the Qatari Emir, the Prime Minister of Turkey, and of course Hamas leader Khaled Mashal in Cairo to discuss the Gaza crisis. And of course we had Hisham Ghani, the Egyptian Prime Minister, crossing the border into the territory, condemning Israeli actions. The new Egypt, Dr. Al-Hashimi, is assuming a high profile this time around, isn't it?
Surely it is. This is very much to do with two aspects.
Right.
Number one, the historic leadership role Egypt enjoyed even when it was under a secular government. Mm-hmm. And secondly, because of the recent changes in the aftermath of what is called Arab Spring,
right,
the downfall of a military dictatorship and the establishment of some sort of democratic process in that very potentially powerful neighboring country to occupied Palestine. In this respect, because the focus is on Gaza, I would like to contribute 2 points. One of them is historic and the other one is contemporary. First, the historic. Mm-hmm. Gaza is a city called named among the Arab world as Ghazat Hashim. Ghazat Hashim is an embodiment to the fact that the great grandfather of the Prophet, whose name was Amr al-Ula, his mother name, mother given name Amr al-Ula, but same name Hashim, was buried in that part of the world.
Right.
And he has a tomb, and many Palestinians go and pay homage, and they take the spirit of Islamic fight for the for the implementation of justice in their life. So Ghazat Hashim must be a very resilient state in any aspect. The aggressors can never approach it. True, they have military superiority. They bring all those atrocities you mentioned in the introduction.
Right.
Lately, 160 people were martyred, 1,200 people were injured in the November incidents. But when it comes to the play of the role of showing the resistance of the people and showing the support, of course, the people who live now in that city not only take the aspiration of the history, but they take a spirit of brotherhood from a neighboring country which is being presided by a new president. Hashim, regarding the historic element of the matter, was well received by the Roman emperor of the day, who met Hashim in that part of the world. And the purpose for Hashim going there was mainly trade, because he was the one who established the summer trade to Syria from Mecca and that part of Arabia.
Great.
So the friendship between the grandfather of the Prophet and the emperor of the Roman Empire is well documented in history, so there shouldn't be any let us say, animosity between the East and the West as it comes in Gaza as a flashpoint.
Great.
So a word of wisdom and a suggestion I pass to Barack Hussein Obama, who met me in 1983 in my office at Columbia University. He knows that I am the 37th descendants of Hashim, as my name indicates, but I'm using this podium to pass him this recommendation that he should not give a blank check to the Zionist occupiers of that parcel of the land, and he shouldn't support them to the fullest because, after all, he should look after the American interest, not to what AIPAC dictates on him.
Great.
As for the Egyptian role, you are aware that the Egyptian president belongs to Al-Ikhwan al-Muslimin. Al-Ikhwan al-Muslimin is a Muslim movement began by Hassan al-Banna in 1928. Sam Hassan al-Banna was very active, and you can see some of his photos as in the warrior attire to go and liberate Palestine when he was young. But unfortunately, in a very mysterious circumstances, that founder of Al-Ikhwan al-Muslimin was assassinated in February of 1949.
Right.
I'm not trying to open an axe file in Egypt, because there are a lot of, say, who assassinated him, but a movement coming into power, again, I have a lot to say about this matter.
We have just only one minute left for that question.
Yes. The only point I'm trying to share here is the Egyptians are living in a bordering country, and Hosni Mubarak tried to erect an iron wall and prevent any support to the Gazian and the people who have been besieged in that city.
Right.
So, for sure, a person such as Mercy should do something which is different. And I guess if he does it in coordination with the forces of resistance in the Muslim and the Arab world, that would be a great achievement. And
excellent.
He will enter the wide doors of history.
Great. Thank you very much indeed, and for providing us with that historical background. Now, we're going to take a short break. After the break, we'll be talking about the new geopolitics in the Middle East in 2012. So please do stay with Central Stage. Hello again, it's great to have you back with us. Now, geopolitics in the Middle East changed forever in 2012, and this affected Israel very much indeed. Dr. Khani, some analysts believe that Israel at the moment is in the worst geopolitical situation it's ever been for decades, particularly paying attention to the fact that Egypt, which is governed by an Islamic government, and now we have the new constitution, which is based on Islamic rules, is actually neighboring this country.
That's true. I mean, when we talk about Middle East and geopolitics of the Middle East, again, historically talking, it started to change in 1979 when the Islamic Republic of Iran was established and the Shah regime, was overthrown by the Islamists. So that was the beginning of a process of changing the geopolitics of the Middle East. And now what is happening in Egypt is another turning point. For two reasons, these two countries are very important for the region and for the Islamic world. I mean, the huge population that these two countries have.
Right.
The historical role that they played in the awakening of the Islamic communities, Islamic societies across the globe, not only in the Middle East. And the political role that these two countries played in the making of the history of the region. So in that sense, Iran and Egypt are so similar. So what is happening now in Egypt and what has happened in 2012 and what we expect to continue happening in 2013, I guess could somehow complete the other puzzles of this changing geopolitics of the Middle East, as you mentioned. Right. And it, to some extent, it goes back to the fact that now in Egypt, we have a government. He comes from an Islamic background and have the huge demands of the Egyptian people for a change, not only in domestic politics, but also in foreign policy. So I would like to remind you again that for the last 30 years, in Egypt, we had a secular government, a dictatorship, a lifetime president, which has the backing of the United States and the West.
Right.
And Israelis, I mean, after the Camp David Accord, they had absolute peace of mind about their borders with Egypt, and they knew that Egypt, although it is a Muslim country, it is an Arab country, but it is an ally
Right.
of the United States and an ally of Tel Aviv.
But the accord still is intact.
It is there. I mean, we should be realistic.
Mm.
I mean, the new government is not, or maybe will not be in a position to abolish the accord because of the consequences.
Right.
But we know that those who are in power in Cairo, because of the demand of the Egyptian people, they are deeply dissatisfied with the accord. And it is likely, maybe not very likely, but it is likely that sooner or later we can hear voices about reviewing it or again put it in a referendum, something like that. Even with the accord being there, Israelis now are so concerned that what is going to happen, what is going to happen to the future of the relationship between Tel Aviv and Cairo.
Right.
As I mentioned, just a couple of years ago, Israeli had a peaceful mind from this huge neighbor that they had. They have been looking at Hosni Mubarak as a very close partner.
Right.
Now they lost him, and now we have an Islamic government who has, I mean, the important issue here is the demand of the streets of Egypt, the people.
Right.
Majority of the people want somehow a government policy in which they can see the support, maybe some kind of unconditional support for the Palestinians. The opening of the Rafah
crossing
forever. And supporting logistically,
right.
maybe something more.
You're talking about the support of the people in the street, but you know the fact of the matter is that in the elections that so far have been held, the turnout has been 30%, 33%. And even considering that, when we look at the results, we see that there is the majority of the Muslims, those who support the constitution, the parliament, also in the presidential election, has been quite slim. So based on those figures, how sustainable do you think
yes.
this path is?
Exactly. You are completely right. I mean, comparatively speaking, I mean, I'm just comparing what we are seeing now in Egypt, what has been there a couple of years ago during Mubarak. So although the majority who are supporting Ikhwan al-Muslimin or Muslim Brotherhood are not the absolute majority or even overwhelming majority, but still they are majority. And they can determine the future of Egypt. They can determine the future of the foreign policy of Egypt. But there are challenges, I mean, no doubt. And most of, most important maybe now these days are the economic challenge which the new government is facing.
Right.
And unless the government can find a solution for this current crisis, which is a very, very serious situation, we should maybe wait for turbulences maybe on the streets in the future.
In 2013. Thank you very much indeed for that, Dr. Khani. Now, let's talk a little bit about one very important development in 2012. And that development was actually Palestinian status upgrade. So, though not to a full member, Palestine's status at the UN was eventually upgraded to observer non-member late November 2012 from observer entity. So observer non-member state, actually. So the state was mentioned. And that despite United States and Israel's warning. We know that Mahmoud Abbas referred to it as Palestine's birth certificate. And it was one of the most electrifying moments in the General Assembly's recent history. Dr. Al-Hashimi, it was not as easy as that, was it? We know that UN diplomats and officials, including the president of the UN General Assembly, were quite worried about the possible reduction of UN funding from the United States. And we know that it actually supplies 22% of the regular UN budget. And they're worried that this may reduce. Jeremy, who is actually the head of that organization, he said that the reduction would have dire financial implications for the United Nations. So considering such financial threats, this UN move was very bold indeed, wasn't it?
Since the focus of your question is economy, my 2-cent input would be covering a point which has to do with the internal economic climate of the United States. Mm-hmm. As you are aware, if the American government wants to persist mm-hmm. on this wrong foreign policy, which is being hijacked by a foreign rogue state, mm-hmm. It will miserably affect its own people. More people will come to the streets demonstrating for the loss of the jobs. Probably you heard the GM, one of the biggest auto manufacturers, brought to halt, and its shares came down to 57 cents per share. So the American industry is not being sustained, unfortunately. One may ask why. Of course, the reason is all these unnecessary wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the open check given to a rogue state from the American taxpayers.
Right.
Of course, this cannot continue. The American are between two clutches. One is this rogue state, which dictates and hijacks the American foreign policy, and the other is the internal demand. People are extremely unhappy for losing jobs and losing their source of livelihood by the closures of the plants, and probably you heard about the mortgage meltdown in 2008 and all the promises Barack Hussein Obama gave, none of them was manifested in the first term. I'm very much hopeful after congratulating him
right.
for being elected for the second term to be able to do something different. And he cannot do something different without liberating his foreign policy from this particular rogue state, because without that, he is ridiculing himself. Because
right.
it is known in the world politics that Palestine, occupied Palestine, is the flashpoint. The whole world is being kept as a captive. The United Nations, supposed to provide peace among warring nations.
Right.
And that office cannot be hijacked as the administration of George W. Bush did in before going and occupying Iraq. So the international community, I guess, especially after strengthening NAM in its last meeting in Tehran, I would suggest that they should put an ultimatum to the American government. Their contribution is very much needed for the sustenance of the United Nations, but most importantly, the independent decision of the Security Council need to be respected and observed.
Right.
And the mere existence of the UN glass building in eastern Manhattan in New York should not be held as a reason to hold the whole world organization as a captive.
I understand, but there is one point I want to mention. I agree that there's been an economic meltdown and credit crunch and all these, you know, problems in the U.S. But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. is currently, you know, providing 22% of the U.N. budget. So the amount of pressure that the U.S. can actually impose on the U.N. is quite high, isn't it?
It is high. As you are aware, in case if the ultimatum I referred to in above point comes to an effect, I guess the other contributors in the different parts of the world should come forth and say to the UN, look, if you cannot keep your independent decision because of the existence of the UN headquarters in New York, let us move it to somewhere else, a more neutral city. I suggest Vienna, for example, because it has been a good, attractive point to the bank accounts of many politicians. So one can find good contributors and one can move it. But the place is not important, especially when we live in an electronic era. You see, this interview a few years ago would not have been possible, but nowadays it has been made very easy.
Right.
The producer of the show contacted me 2 weeks ago. I couldn't give her time a week ago. I suggested today, and this interview now is on the air. The same thing
Our
can
pleasure.
Be done as far as the function of the UN is concerned, because we do not need physical building. We need places to provide security for the people who have been assembling. And of course, the country has to be, let us...
Right. It seems that we've actually lost Dr. Ahmad Al-Hashimi. We hope we can have him quite soon back with us. Now, we'll take a short break. After the break, we'll be talking about one of the most unfortunate failures of the world in 2012. So please do stay with Central Stage. Hello again. It's great to have you back with us. Now, before we talk about the one of the biggest failures of the world in 2012, let's talk about what happened in October. We know that a 15-year-old Pakistani girl was shot in the head by the Taliban, who call themselves Muslims, but in fact they're actually not, for promoting girls' education. An outspoken champion of girls' right to education who knew all about risk and fear and its consequences when it comes to taking on the Taliban. Now, November the 10th was commemorated as Malala Day. The day is intended to represent the goal of education for all children. Now, the point that I'd like to mention, which is very interesting, which you've probably noticed, is that Malala even finished, you know, Dr. Hani, on the actually second in Time Magazine's Person of the Year list. I think it's fair to say that Malala has become an international icon, hasn't she?
Yes, I think so. I do agree. Just one point I just wanted to mention about the previous question, which was a very important one, and we didn't mention it.
Okay.
You raised the very important issue of the new status of the Palestinians in the UN. I just wanted to say that there are at least two huge impacts and results for that. And this is the achievements for the Palestinians. The first one, that this new status actually gives the Palestinians a very stronger voice in international system. And also, I mean, it definitely enhanced the position of Palestinians. I mean, I'm talking about Hamas and Fatah together, the Palestinians, somehow diplomatically.
So one of the few instances where they both come together.
Exactly. I mean, it happened at a time that they are now approaching each other and now initiating friendship and unity.
Right.
So it shows that if they are together, and maybe it can also affect this unity process and bring them closer and closer to each other. This is one point. Right. The other point is the fact that by this new status, they have the right, Palestinians, as an entity, they have a member state. They have that opportunity to actually bring and take the Israelis to the international tribunal, international courts, for the crime against humanity. And that was one of the biggest concerns of the Israelis and Americans.
But the question is whether they really do that.
The possibility is there. So, again, theoretically speaking, they have these two achievements by this new status, which are very important.
Right.
Now, going back to the question, yes, it was a very, very sad tragedy what happened. And it shows that how an ideology of violence, something that comes from misinterpretation of Islamic or any other religion, can lead to these kind of performances, these kind of interpretations that justifies doing these terrible things, not only to one girl, but also the whole society. I mean, Taliban have been there in Afghanistan for a number of years, and that is typically what they have done to the Afghani people,
but, you know,
especially
supporting education. Prophet Muhammad, actually, peace upon him, was one of the proponents of education, including, of course, girls.
Exactly. I mean, Islam, I mean, has the, I mean, the most important and maybe the most advanced rules about the how to behave, how to deal with the females, girls, women. But unfortunately, this very, very wrong interpretation of some certain codes, maybe in the Hadith or Quran, this is something that has led Taliban to these awful things
and,
to be done.
Dr. Khani, there's one other point that I wanted to mention, but I think I can't mention because we have just a few seconds to the end of the show. So we wanted to talk about the, you know, Vought's failure to stop bloodshed in Syria and also about guests' opinion about the most important development in the year 2012. But unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for the moment. But before I go, I'd like to thank again my top guests, Dr. Ahmad Al-Hashimi, the founding director of Ihsan Muslim Heritage Society in Toronto, and Dr. Muhammad Hassan Khani, political scientist and faculty member at Imam Sadegh University. Thanks very much, Enid, for coming over, for talking to us, and for those insights.
Thank you so much.
Until next week, from me and our guests, it's goodbye for now. Thanks very much, Enid, for watching. Thank you very much. It's great to have you with us. Thanks.